the first time. When he got to the stand, he started to sit down, and the judge had to stop him so he could remain standing while taking the oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. After the preliminary questions that established who Falgoni was and what he did, I zeroed in on Hector Moya's habeas case, asking Falgoni to go through the steps that led him to subpoena Gloria Dayton to appear for a deposition. Well, it started when Mr. Moya told me that the gun that was found by police in his hotel room was not his and that it had been planted, Falgoni answered. Through our investigation, we concluded that there was a strong possibility that the gun was already hidden in the room when the police arrived to make the arrest.
And what did that tell you?
Well, that if the gun was planted, as Mr. Moya insisted, then it was planted by somebody who had been in that room before the police arrived.
Where did that lead you?
We looked at who had been in that room during the 4 days Mr. Moya was staying there before the bust. And through a process of elimination, we narrowed our focus to two women who had been to the room multiple times in those days. They were prostitutes, and they used the names Glory Days and Trina Trix. That's spelled with three X's. Trina Trix was easy to find because she was still working under that name in Los Angeles and had a website and all of that. I contacted her and arranged to meet her.
Falgoni stopped there, waiting for further direction. I had told him when we discussed his testimony not to take big bites out of the story, to keep his answers short. I also told him not to volunteer anything about paying Trina Trix for her cooperation. I didn't want to drop that piece of information into Bill Forsyth's lap.
"Will you tell the jury what happened at that meeting?" I asked.
Falgoni nodded eagerly.
"Well, first she revealed that her real name is Trina Rafferty. She also acknowledged knowing Mr. Moya and being in his room back at that time. She denied ever planting a gun in the room, but admitted that her friend Glory Days had told her she did."
I did my best to feign confusion, raising one hand in an "I don't get it" gesture. "But why would she plant the gun?" This set off an objection from Bill Forsyth and a 5-minute exchange of arguments at sidebar. Eventually, I was allowed to proceed with my question. This is one of the few places in a criminal trial where the defense has an advantage. Everything about a trial is stacked against the defense, but the one thing no judge wants is a reversal on appeal due to judge's error. So the wide majority of jurists, and this included Judge Nancy Lego, bend over backwards to allow the defense to proceed as it wishes, as long as it stays close to the lines of evidentiary procedure and decorum. Lego knew that every time she sustained an objection from Forsyth, she risked being second-guessed and reversed by a higher court. By contrast, rejection of prosecutorial objections rarely carried the same risk. In practice, this meant that giving the defense wide latitude in mounting its case was the safest judicial route to take. Once I was back at the lectern, I again asked Falgoni why Glory Days would plant a gun in Hector Moya's hotel room. "Trina Rafferty told me that both she and Glory Days were working for the DEA, and they wanted to put Moya away for—" Forsyth practically became airborne when he jumped up to object.
"Your Honor, where is the foundation for that? The state strenuously objects to the witness and defense counsel using this trial to wander aimlessly through this valley of innuendo."
The judge was swift in her response.
"I think Mr. Forsyth is correct this time. Mr. Holler, lay the foundation or move on to another topic with the witness."
So much for the defense advantage. I took a few seconds to pull back and retool the examination. I then led Falgoni through a series of questions that established the parameters of Moya's arrest and conviction, paying careful attention to the federal code that allowed prosecutors to enhance the charges and seek a life sentence because he was found in possession of a firearm and 2 ounces of cocaine, a quantity deemed by federal code to be more than for personal use. It took me nearly a half hour, but eventually I got back to the question of why Glory Days, who we had now established was Gloria Dayton, would plant a gun in Moya's room. Forsythe objected again, saying the groundwork I had just covered was insufficient, but finally the judge agreed with me and overruled the objection. We believed, based on facts brought forward in our investigation, that Gloria Dayton was a DEA informant and that she planted the gun in Mr. Moya's room on the orders of her DEA handler. There, it was on the record. The cornerstone of the defense. I glanced over at Forsythe. He was writing furiously, even angrily, on a legal pad and not looking up. He probably didn't even want to see how the jury was reacting to this. And who was her DEA handler? I asked. An agent named James Marco, Fulgoni replied. I looked down and acted like I was checking notes on my own legal pad for a few moments so the jurors could let that name, James Marco, sink in deep. Mr. Holler, the judge prompted, ask your next question. I looked at Fulgoni and thought about which way to go now that I had Marco's name before the jury. Mr. Holler, the judge prompted again. Yes, Your Honor, I said quickly. Mr. Fulgoni, where did you get the name James Marco as Gloria Dayton's supposed DEA handler?
From Trina Rafferty. She said that both she and Gloria worked for Marco as snitches.
Did Trina Rafferty say whether Marco asked her to plant the gun in Mr. Moya's hotel room? Before Fulgoni could answer, Forsythe objected angrily, calling the whole line of questioning hearsay. The judge sustained it without allowing argument from me. I asked for a sidebar, and the judge reluctantly signaled us up to the bench. I got right into it. Your Honor, the defense finds itself between a rock and a hard place. The court has sustained the objection against hearsay testimony from the witness. That leaves me no alternative but to at least try to get the testimony directly from Agent Marco. As you know, Marco was on the original witness list submitted nearly 4 weeks ago to the court. However, we've been unable to make service of a subpoena to Agent Marco or the DEA in general. Lego shrugged. And what is the remedy you want from the court? To allow hearsay evidence? That's not going to happen, Mr. Holler. I started nodding before she was finished. I know that, Judge, but I was thinking that a direct order to appear from you and carrying the blessing of the prosecution could go a long way toward getting Agent Marco into this courtroom. Lego looked at Forsythe and raised her eyebrows. The ball was now Forsythe's.
Your Honor, I am happy to give my blessing, he said. Whether it works or not, all Agent Marco will do is show up and deny these outlandish accusations. It will be a highly decorated agent's word against the word of a whore, and I'll...
Mr. Forsythe, the judge broke in, her voice well above a whisper. You will show a little more decorum and respect in my courtroom.
I apologize, Your Honor, Forsythe said quickly. Prostitute. What I meant to say is that this will come down to the agent's word against the prostitutes, and the state has no worries when it comes to that.
Prosecutorial arrogance is a deadly sin when it comes to a criminal court trial. It was the first time I had really seen it in Forsythe, and I knew that he might end up eating those words before the case was over.
Very well, let's proceed, the judge said. I will adjourn for the day 15 minutes early so that we can fashion the order to appear.
We returned to our positions, and I looked at Fulgoni waiting for me on the witness stand. He had so far come off as cool, calm, and collected. I was about to change that and take him in a direction we had not discussed or rehearsed in the days building up to the trial. Mr. Fulgoni, I began, how much of this gun-planting theory did Gloria Dayton confirm for you?
None, Fulgoni said. I subpoenaed her for a deposition, but she was murdered before I ever spoke to her.
I nodded and looked down at my notes.
And how long have you been practicing law?
The abrupt change in direction surprised young Sly.
2.5 years next month.
And have you been involved in a trial before?
You mean in court?
I almost laughed out loud. If Fulgoni had not been my own witness, I would have destroyed him with that answer. As it was, I needed to damn near leave him for dead before I was finished with my direct.
"Yes, in court," I said dryly.
"None, so far. But I know lawyers who say the object is to stay out of the courtroom and to take care of business before it comes to that."
"Viewing it from where I stand now, that's not bad advice, Mr. Falgoni. Can you tell the jury how you, just 2 years out of law school and never in a courtroom before, landed Hector Moya as a client?"
Falgoni nodded.
"He was a referral."
"From whom?"
"My father, actually."
"And how did that come about?" Falgoni gave me a look that I interpreted as a warning that I was crossing into a territory that he had deemed off-limits when we had last discussed his testimony. I gave him a look back that said, "Too fucking bad. I have you under oath. I own you." I had to prompt him to answer. "Please tell the jury how your father came to refer Mr. Moya to you."
Well, my father is incarcerated in the same federal prison where Hector is. They know each other, and my father referred him to me."
"Okay, so you took on the case 2 years out of law school and filed the habeas petition, hoping to have Mr. Moya's life sentence vacated, correct?"
"Yes."
"Because the firearm that got him the life sentence was planted?"
"Yes."
"And you believed it was planted by Gloria Dayton, correct?"
"Correct."
"Based on what Trina Rafferty told you?"
"Correct."
"And before filing this habeas petition, did you study the transcript from Mr. Moya's trial in 2006?
"Most of it, yes."
"Did you read the transcript of the sentencing hearing when the judge sent him to life in prison?"
"I did, yes."
I asked the judge to allow me to approach the witness with a document I entered as the second defense exhibit, the transcript of Hector Moya's sentencing on November 4, 2006. The judge approved, and I came forward to hand the document to Falgoni. It was already folded back to a page with highlighted material I wanted him to read to the jury. "What is it that you have there, Mr. Falgoni?"
"It's the transcript from the sentencing hearing in federal court. It's the judge's comments."
"Is that what you read when you were preparing to file the habeas on Mr. Moya's behalf?"
"Yes."
"Okay, what is the judge's name?"
"The Honorable Lisa Bass."
"Can you please read to the jury the quotes from Judge Bass that I have highlighted on the page?" Falgoni leaned forward and began reading.
"Mr. Moya, the pre-sentencing report on you is abysmal. You have conducted a life full of crime, attaining a high rank in the murderous Sinaloa cartel. You are a cold and violent man, and you have lost all aspects of humanity. You sell death. You are death. And it is my good fortune to be able to sentence you to life in prison today. I wish I could do more. To be honest, I wish you were eligible for the death penalty, because I would have used it."
Falgoni stopped there. The judge's comments continued, but I figured that the jury had a good enough taste of them. "Okay, so you read that sentencing transcript sometime last year as you prepared the habeas petition on Mr. Moya's behalf, correct?"
"Yes."
"Therefore, you knew when you prepared the subpoena for Gloria Dayton what kind of history Mr. Moya had, correct?"
"Yes."
"So then, Mr. Falgoni, did it ever cross your mind as a young, inexperienced attorney that it might be dangerous to subpoena Gloria Dayton to a deposition in which you would undoubtedly ask her about planting the gun in Hector Moya's hotel room?"
"Danger from whom?"
"Let me ask the questions, Mr. Falgoni. That's how it works in a real trial." There was a slight murmur of laughter from the direction of the jury, but I acted as though I hadn't heard it. "Didn't you, Mr. Falgoni, understand that by issuing a subpoena and naming Gloria Dayton as the person who planted a gun in Hector Moya's hotel room, you were placing her in great danger?"
"That's why I did it under seal. It was not public information. Nobody knew."
"What about your client? Didn't he know?"
"I didn't tell him."
"Did you tell your father, who lived in the same prison with Moya?"
But it doesn't make sense. He wouldn't have killed her.
Who wouldn't?
Hector Moya.
Mr. Falcone, you need to answer the questions I ask you. That way we don't have confusion. Did you, or did you not, tell your father that you had identified as Gloria Dayton the woman who you believed planted the gun in Mr. Moya's room?
Yes, I told my father.
And did you ever ask him if he had told Mr. Moya before Gloria Dayton's death?
I did, yeah, but it didn't matter. She was Moya's ticket out. He would not have killed her.
I nodded and looked down at my notes for a moment before continuing. Then why did you ask your father if he had given her name to Mr. Moya?
Because I didn't understand at first. I thought maybe it was possible that he had acted out of vengeance or something like that.
Do you think that now?
No, because I understand. He needed her alive in order to win the habeas. We needed her.
I hoped the alternative to the scenario I had just explored was obvious to the jurors. At the moment, I was being subtle about it. I wanted them to come to the understanding on their own, and then I would reinforce it with further testimony. When people think they have discovered or earned a certain knowledge on their own, they are more apt to hold on to it. I glanced at Mallory Gladwell in the jury box and saw her writing in one of the notebooks each juror is given. It looked to me like my alpha juror had gotten the subtlety. I looked back at Falcone. It would have been the perfect moment to finish, but I had Falcone on the stand and under oath. I decided not to miss any chance of hammering home the basic theory of the defense. Mr. Falcone, I'm trying to get a fix on the timing of your habeas petition involving Hector Moya. You filed the case and subpoenaed Gloria Dayton in early November, correct?
Yes.
She was then murdered on the night of November 11th, going into the 12th, right?
I don't know the exact dates.
It's okay, I do. By the morning of November 12th, Gloria was dead, and yet it was another 5 months before anything happened on the habeas, correct?
Like I said, I don't know the dates. I think that is right.
Why did you wait until April of this year to get things going on the case and to subpoena DEA agent James Marco, among others? What caused the delay until then, Mr. Falcone? Falcone shook his head like he didn't know the answer.
I was just strategizing the case. Sometimes the law moves slowly, you know?
Was it because you realized that if Hector Moya actually needed Gloria Dayton alive, there might be someone else out there who needed her dead?
No, I don't think that's...
Were you afraid, Mr. Falcone, that you had opened a can of worms with your habeas petition and that you yourself might be in danger?
No, I was never afraid.
Were you ever threatened by someone in law enforcement to stall or shut the Moya case down?
No, never.
How did Agent Marco react to being subpoenaed in April?
I don't actually know. I wasn't there.
Has he ever fulfilled the subpoena and sat for a deposition with you?
No, not yet.
Has he personally threatened you if you continue the habeas case?
No, he has not.
I stared at Falcone for a long moment. He now looked like a scared little boy who would lie his way out of anything if he could. Now was the time. I looked up at the judge and said I had no further questions. Chapter 32. Forsyth kept Falcone on the stand for a full 90 minutes of hardball cross-examination. If I had made the young lawyer look foolish at times, then the prosecutor made him look downright incompetent. Forsyth clearly had a mission to accomplish with his cross, and that was the total destruction of Falcone's credibility. I had used young Sly to get several salient points on the record. Forsyth's only hope of undermining those points with the jury was to undermine their source. He had to leave it so the jurors would dismiss Falcone's testimony in its entirety.
He came close to mission accomplished by the end of the 90 minutes.
Falgoni looked wrung out. His clothes seemed somehow wilted, his posture was slumped, and he was answering questions monosyllabically, agreeing to almost anything the prosecutor suggested in the form of a question. It was the Stockholm syndrome. He was trying to please his captor. I tried to intervene and help where I could with objections, but Forsyth deftly kept his questioning inside the lines, and one after the other the objections went down overruled. Finally, at 4:15, it was over. Falgoni was excused, and he left the witness stand like a man who never wanted to set foot in a courtroom again, despite being a lawyer. I stepped back to the rail and whispered to Sisko in the first row, telling him to make sure young Sly didn't leave. I still needed to talk to him. The judge sent the jury home and adjourned court for the day. She invited Forsyth and me back to her chambers to work on the order to appear that would hopefully bring James Marco to court. I told Lorna that drawing up the order would not take too long, and she should go down and get her car out of the underground parking garage where she left it every morning. I caught up to Forsyth in the hallway behind the courtroom that led to the judge's chambers. "Nice job on Falgoni," I said. "At least now he has some courtroom experience." Forsyth turned and waited for me. "Me? You were the one who started it, and he was your witness." A sacrifice to the gods. It had to be done. "I don't know what you're hoping to get out of this Moya angle, but it's not going to fly, Mick." "We'll see." "And what's with all the names on the new list? I've got kids I'd like to spend time with tonight." "Give it to Langford. He has the time. I think he ate his kids." Forsyth was laughing as we entered the chambers. The judge was already at her desk, turned to the computer terminal on the side. "Gentlemen, let's get this done so we can beat some traffic." 15 minutes later, I left through the courtroom. The judge had issued the order to appear. The sheriff's department would be charged with delivering it to the DEA's office the next morning. It ordered the DEA to show cause as to why Agent James Marco should not appear in court by 10 a.m. Wednesday. That meant either Marco or a lawyer for the DEA would need to show up. If that didn't work, then Judge Lego would issue a bench warrant for Marco's arrest, and things would really get interesting. I found Sisko and young Sly sharing a bench in the hallway. One of Moya's men was on his own bench across the hall. The other had trailed Lorna as she went down to get the car. I walked over to Sisko and Falgoni and told young Sly that I knew it had been a rough day, but that I greatly appreciated the help he had given my client's case. I told him I was still looking forward to working with him on the habeas case in federal court.
"I was right about you, Haller," he said.
"Yeah, when was that?" I asked.
"When I said you were an asshole."
He stood up to leave.
"I nailed it."
Sisko and I watched him stride to the elevator bank. The good thing about working late into the day in the courthouse was that the elevator crowds thinned out and the wait wasn't so bad. Falgoni caught a ride quickly and was gone.
"Nice guy," Sisko said.
"You should meet his father," I said. "Even nicer."
"I shouldn't speak ill, though. A guy like that, I'll probably end up working for him someday," Sisko said.
"You're probably right." I handed him my copy of the judge's order. Sisko unfolded the document and looked it over.
"Somebody up there at Roybal will probably use this to wipe his ass with."
"Probably, but it's all part of the game. Just in case, we need to be ready for Marco on Wednesday."
"Right."
We stood up and started heading toward the elevators. Moya's man followed.
"You going to the loft?" I asked Sisko.
Team Haller had been meeting regularly at the loft after court each afternoon. We recounted the occurrences of the day, as well as talked and brainstormed about the next one. It was a way of sharing successes and failures. Today I thought we had been more successful than not. It would be a good meeting.
"I'll be there," Sisko said. "I just have one stop to make first."
"Okay then." Outside the courthouse, I walked over to Spring Street
and saw Lorna's Lexus parked at the curb in front of two Lincoln Town cars that were also waiting for lawyers from the courthouse. I walked down the sidewalk and past the Lincolns, and almost opened the back door of Lorna's car, but decided not to embarrass her. I got in the front. "I guess this makes me the Lexus lawyer now," I said. "Maybe the movie guys will make a sequel." She didn't smile.
"Are we going to the loft?" she asked.
"If you don't mind, I want to make sure we're all set for tomorrow."
"Of course."
She abruptly pulled away from the curb without checking the traffic lane and got blasted by a motorist she'd cut off. I waited a few moments, deciding whether I should wade in. I had been married to her once briefly. I knew her moods, and that the quiet, clipped dialogue version could boil over if left simmering on the stove too long. "So what's up? You're upset."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes, you are. Tell me."
"Why did you make Sylvester Jr. wait for you after court today?"
I squinted, trying to see the connection between making Junior wait and her being upset. "I don't know. I guess because I wanted to thank him for testifying. It was a rough day for him."
"And whose fault was that?"
Now I realized why she was flatlining me. She felt sorry for young Sly. "Look, Lorna, that kid is a complete incompetent. I had to expose that because if I didn't, I was going to look just as incompetent when Forsythe mopped the floor with him. Besides, someday he's going to thank me for that. It's better he get his shit together now than somewhere down the line."
"Whatever."
"Yeah, whatever. You know something? Earl never gave me any shit about how I run my cases.
And look what happened to him."
That hit me like an arrow in the back.
"What?
What's that supposed to mean?"
"Nothing."
"Come on, Lorna, don't lay that shit on me. Don't you think I already carry enough guilt about it?" I was actually surprised it had taken her 2 months to get to this.
"You knew you were being followed. They put a tracker on the car."
"Yeah, a tracker. So they would know where I was going, not so they could kill us. That was never on our radar. They put a tracker on the car, not an IED, for Christ's sake."
"You should have known when you went up to see Moya, they would know you figured everything out and were a danger."
"That's crazy, Lorna. Because I didn't figure everything out, not then and not now. I'm still flying by the seat of my pants on this case. Besides that, the day before, Sisko said they weren't seeing anything, and I'd made an executive decision to pull the Indians back because they were costing us a lot, and you were on my back all the time about the money. And you were on my back all the time about the money.
So you're blaming me?"
"No, I'm not blaming you. I'm not blaming anybody. But obviously somebody missed something because we were not in the clear.
And Earl got killed."
"Yeah, Earl got killed. And so far they've gotten away with it. And I have to live with making the call to pull back on the surveillance. Not that it would have changed anything." I raise my hands in an "I give up" gesture. "Look, I don't know why all this comes to the surface right now, but can we stop talking about it? I'm in the middle of a trial and I'm juggling chainsaws. All of this doesn't really help. I see Earl's face every night when I try to go to sleep. If it helps you to know he haunts me, well, he does." We rode in silence for the next 25 minutes, until finally we pulled into the parking lot behind the loft on Santa Monica. I could tell by the number of cars in the lot, including three beat-up panel vans, that our staff meeting would have musical accompaniment. Under the house rules, bands were allowed to practice in their lofts after 4 p.m. Lorna and I said nothing as we rode the freight elevator up. Our shoes made angry sounds on the wood floor. They echoed across the empty loft as we headed to the boardroom. Only Jennifer Aronson was already there. I remembered that Sisko had said that he had something to do first.
"So how did it go?"
Aronson asked. I nodded as I pulled out a seat and sat down. "Pretty good. Things are in play. I was even able to suggest to Forsythe that he let Langford vet the new witness list."
"I meant the trial. How is Fulgoni?"
I glanced at Lorna, aware of her sympathies for Sly Jr.
He served his purpose.
Is he off yet?
Yeah, we're finished with him for now.
And so you gave the new list, and what happened?
Jennifer had prepared the new witness list, making sure that every new name had some connection to the case, so that we could argue its place on it. That is, every name but one. Forsythe objected all over the place, and the judge gave him till tomorrow morning to respond. So I want you there, since you know the names better than me.
Are you clear in the morning?
Jennifer nodded.
Yes. Will I be making the response, or just whispering to you?
You respond. She brightened at the thought of going up against Forsythe in court.
What if he brings up Stratton Sturgis?
I thought for a moment before responding. I heard someone riffing on an electric guitar somewhere in the building. First of all, there was no if about that. Sturgis is going to come up. When he does, you start to answer, and then you sort of look at me as if to ask if you're saying too much. I'll step in then and take it from there. The new witness list I had submitted was a carefully constructed part of our defense strategy. Every person we had added had at least a tangential connection to the Gloria Dayton case. We could easily argue for his or her inclusion and testimony. However, the truth was, we would actually call few of them to testify. Most of them had been added to the list in an effort to cloak a single name, Stratton Sturgis. Sturgis was the depth charge. He was not directly or indirectly connected to Dayton. He did, however, live for the past 20 years across the street from a house in Glendale, where two drug dealers were assassinated in 2003. It was in the investigation of those murders that I believed an unholy alliance was somehow struck between then-Detective Lee Lankford and DEA agent James Marco. I needed to root that alliance out and find a way to tie it in with Gloria. It was called relevance. I had to make the Glendale case relevant to the Dayton case, or I would never get it to the jury.
So you're hoping Lankford does the vetting and comes up with Stratton Sturgis' connection, Jennifer said.
I nodded. If we get lucky.
And then he makes a mistake.
I nodded again. If we get luckier. As if on cue, Sisko entered the boardroom. I realized that the big man hadn't made a sound as he crossed the loft. He went to the coffee pot and started pouring a cup.
Sisko, that's old, Lorna warned. From this morning. It's not even hot.
It will have to do, Sisko said. He put the glass pot down on the cold burner and swallowed a gulp from the cup. We all made faces. He smiled. What? He said. I need the caffeine. We're setting up on the house and I could be up all night. So everything is set? I asked. He nodded. I just checked it out. We're ready. Then let's hope Lankford does his job. And then some.
He started pouring more of the dead coffee into his cup. Let me just make a fresh pot, Lorna said.
She got up and came around the table to her husband. No, it's fine, Sisko said. I can't stay long anyway. Have to get up there with the crew.
Lorna stopped. There was a pained expression on her face.
What? Sisko asked.
What is this you're doing? She asked. How dangerous.
Sisko shrugged and looked at me. We've taken precautions, I said. But they are men with guns. We're always careful, Sisko added. I now realized where the heated discussion between Lorna and me in the car had come from. She was worried about her husband, worried that the fate that had befallen Earl Briggs would come to her house next. Chapter 33. Sisko called me at midnight. I was in bed with Kendall, having snuck out my back door and once again taken a cab over the hill to meet her. The protection of Moya's men was 24/7, but I left them behind whenever I met Kendall, because she objected to them and didn't want them near her. As had become our routine during the trial, we'd eaten a late dinner at the sushi bar after she closed her studio,
and then returned to her place. I was deeply asleep and dreaming of car crashes when Sisko called. It took me a moment to adjust to where I was and what the call meant.
"We've got them on tape," Sisko said.
"Who exactly?"
"Both of them, Langford and Marco."
"Together? Same frame?"
"Same frame."
"Good. Did they do anything?"
"Oh yeah, they went inside."
"You mean they broke in?"
"Yep."
"Holy shit, and you've got it?"
"We've got it all, and then some. Marco planted drugs in the house, heroin."
I was almost speechless. This couldn't be any better.
"And you got that on tape too?"
"Got it. We got it all.
Do you want us to break it all down now? Pull out the cameras?"
I thought for a moment before answering.
"No," I finally said. "I want it to stay. We paid Sturgis for 2 weeks. Let's keep it all there. You never know."
"You sure? Do we have the money for that?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
"No, we don't have the money."
"Well, you don't want to stiff these guys."
I almost made a joke about how he'd been stiffing the Indians since Columbus got here, but decided it was not the time for an attempt at humor.
"I'll figure something out."
"Okay.
I'll see you in the morning. Will there be something I can see?"
"Yeah, I'll download it all to Lorna's iPad. You can watch on your way in."
"Okay, good."
After we disconnected, I checked my text file to see if I'd gotten anything from my daughter. I'd been sending trial updates each night, telling her how things were going and the major highlight of each day. They had mostly been negative reports until the defense phase began. Now the highlights would be my highlights. The dispatch I had sent her while riding over the hill in the taxi had been about the points I'd scored with Valenzuela and Fulgoni on the stand. But as usual, there was no return text or acknowledgement of any kind from her. I put the phone down on the bedside table and laid my head back down on the pillow. Kendall's arm came around my chest from behind.
"Who is that?"
"Sisko. He got some good stuff tonight."
"Good for him."
"No, good for me." She squeezed me, and I felt how strong she was after many years of yoga.
"Go to sleep now,"
she said. "I don't think I can," I said. But I tried. I closed my eyes and tried to avoid returning to the dream I'd just come out of. I didn't want that. I tried to think about my daughter riding a black horse with a lightning bolt running down its nose. In the vision, she wore no helmet, and her hair was flowing behind her as the horse she rode galloped across an unfenced field of tall grass. I realized just before drifting off that the girl in the vision was my daughter of a year earlier, at a time when we still spoke regularly and saw each other on weekends. My last thought before succumbing to exhaustion and sleep was to wonder if she would always be frozen at that age in my dreams, or if I would get experiences with her upon which I could build new dreams. 2 hours later, the phone buzzed again. Kendall groaned as I quickly grabbed it off the bedside table and answered without looking at the screen.
"What now?"
"What now? What the hell you think you're doing, treating my son like that in open court?" It wasn't Sisko. It was Sly Fulgoni Sr.
"Sly, look, hold on."
I got up and walked out of the room. I didn't want to disturb Kendall any further than I already had. I sat at the counter in the kitchen and spoke in a low voice into the phone. "Sly, I did what I had to do for my client, and now's not the time to talk about it. Fact is, he got what was coming to him, and it's too late and I'm too tired to talk about it." There was silence for a long moment.
"Did you put me on the list?" he finally asked.
That was what he was really calling about. Himself. Sly needed a vacation from federal prison, so he demanded that his name be put on the amended witness list. He had decided that he wanted to take the bus ride down from Victorville and spend a day or two in L.A. County Jail, just for the change of pace and scenery. It didn't matter that there was no need for testimony from him in the Lacoste trial.
He wanted me to manufacture an argument for his inclusion on the list and transfer down. If I succeeded, I could then always tell the judge I changed my mind and strategy and no longer needed him. He'd be sent back to Victorville after his little vacation.
"Yes," I said, "you're on the list, but it has not been accepted yet. It comes up first thing today, and it doesn't help you waking me up like this. I need my sleep, Sly, so I can be sharp and win the argument."
"Okay, I got it. You get your beauty sleep, Holler. I'll wait to hear from you, and you better not fuck me over on this. My son doesn't know any better. He got a good lesson today."
"Me? I don't need any lessons. You get me down there."
"I'll do my best. Good night."
I disconnected before he could respond and went back into the bedroom. I was going to apologize to Kendall for the second intrusion, but she had already fallen back asleep. I wished I could so easily do the same, but the second call irreparably broke the sleep cycle, and I moved restlessly in the bed for most of the remainder of the night, only nodding off an hour before I was supposed to awaken for the day. That morning, I called a taxi so Kendall could sleep in. Luckily, I had started leaving clothes at her house, and I dressed in a suit that wasn't that fresh, but at least was different from the one I'd worn the day before. I then snuck out of the house without waking her. Lorna was already waiting for me in the Lexus when the taxi pulled up to my house shortly after 8. Moya's men were there too in their car, waiting to escort us downtown. I took 2 minutes to go up to the house to get my briefcase and then came back down and jumped into the car. "Let's go." Lorna abruptly pulled away from the curb. I could tell she had not yet given up her anger with me.
"Hey, I'm not the one who showed up 10 minutes late," she said. "I was the one who was on time and had to sit and wait, not to mention waiting with the 2 cartel goons that give everybody the creeps."
"Okay, okay. Let's just drop it, all right? I had a rough night."
"Aren't you lucky?"
"I don't mean it that way.
I had Sisko waking me up, and then Sly Sr. called to chew me out, and I ended up with like 3 hours total.
Did Sisko put the video on your iPad for me to look at?"
"Yes, it's in the bag in the back."
I reached between the seats to the back seat, where her purse was on the floor. It was the size of a grocery bag, and it weighed a ton.
"What the hell do you have in this thing?"
"Everything."
I didn't ask for further explanation. I managed to pull the bag up to the front seat, open it, and find her iPad. I put the bag on the floor between my feet, lest I pull a muscle leveraging it into the back again.
"It should be right on the screen and ready to go," Lorna said. "Just hit the play button."
I opened her iPad case, lit the screen, and saw the frozen image of the front door of a house I knew to be the home of Stratton Sturgis. The camera angle was from below, and the quality was not great, as the only illumination came from a porch light next to the door. I assumed Sisko's people had used a pinhole camera, hidden in a potted plant or some other porch ornament. The view was from a side angle, so that if anyone approached and knocked on the door, the camera would capture their profile. I hit the play button and watched for a few seconds as nothing moved or happened on the screen. Then, a man stepped onto the porch, hesitated, and glanced behind him. It was Langford. He then turned back and knocked on the door. He waited for the door to be answered. I waited too. Nothing happened. I knew no one would answer the door, but it was a tense moment just the same.
"Which way do you want me to go today?" Lorna asked.
"Just hold on a minute," I said. "Let me watch."
The video was without sound. Langford knocked again with more force. He then looked back off camera and shook his head, seemingly at the direction of someone off screen. He turned and knocked again, even harder. No one answered. A second man stepped up on the porch and moved to Langford's right side so he could look in through the window next to the door. He cupped his eyes as he leaned against the glass. His face was hidden until he leaned back, turned to Langford, and said something. It was James Marco. I froze the screen so I could just look at them. It was an image I knew would cause a sea change in the case,
It was perfectly reasonable and acceptable that Lankford would show up at the front door of a man listed as a defense witness on a case he was assigned to for the district attorney's office. But the confluence of Lankford and DEA agent James Marco on that front porch changed things exponentially. I was looking at digital evidence that tied Marco to Lankford and the events surrounding the murder of Gloria Dayton. At minimum, I felt I was looking at reasonable doubt. I spoke to Lorna without taking my eyes off the screen. Where's Sisko now?
He came home, gave me that, and went to sleep. He said he'd be in court by 10.
I nodded. He deserved the chance to sleep late. Well, he did good.
Did you watch the whole thing? He said watch it to the end.
I pushed the play button. Lankford and Marco grew tired of waiting for the door to be answered and walked off the porch. I waited. Nothing happened. No action on the porch. What am I looking? Then I saw it. It was barely a shadow on the other side of the porch, but I saw it. One or both of the men walked down the side of the house. The video then jumped to another view, this one from a camera in the backyard pointed toward the rear of the house. I noticed that the time count jumped backwards 10 seconds. I watched and waited, and then I saw two figures emerge from both side yards of the house and meet at the rear door. Under the light over the door, I could make out their faces. Again, it was Lankford and Marco. Lankford knocked on the door, but Marco didn't wait for an answer. He squatted down and went to work on the doorknob, obviously attempting to pick the lock. This is amazing, I said. I can't believe we got it.
What exactly is it? Lorna asked. Sisko wouldn't tell me. He said it was top secret, but a game changer.
It is. A game changer, I mean. I'll tell you in a minute. It's not top secret. I silently watched the rest of the video. Marco got the door open and looked back at Lankford and nodded. He then disappeared inside, while Lankford waited outside, his back to the door, and kept watch. The video jumped inside the house to an overhead camera in the kitchen. It was a fisheye lens, most likely housed in a smoke detector. Marco walked beneath the camera from the back door to a hallway, but then turned around and came back to the kitchen. He crossed the floor and went to the refrigerator, opened the freezer, and reached in. He started checking through the various frozen food containers until he selected a package that contained 2 pieces of French bread pizza. Living alone, I knew the brand and the pizza well. Marco carefully opened the box without tearing the flap. He then took out one of the plastic-wrapped pizzas and secured it under his arm while he reached into the pocket of his black leather bomber jacket and removed something. His hand moved too fast for me to identify what he held, but whatever it was, he shoved it into the pizza box and then put the pizza back in on top of it. He returned the box to the freezer under several other packages and turned to the back door. The video jumped outside again, and I saw Marco step out of the house, lock the door, and close it. He had been inside under a minute. He nodded to Lankford, and they separated, each walking down the side of the house they had come from. The video ended there. I looked up to see where we were. Lorna was about to turn onto the 101 from Sunset. I could see down the ramp that the freeway was the usual morning parking lot. I felt the first slight tightening in my chest that always came with thoughts of being late for court. Why'd you go this way?
Because I asked you and you told me to be quiet. You try so many different ways every day, I didn't know what you wanted.
Earl always took pride in beating the traffic. He always tried different ways.
Well, Earl isn't here.
I know. I put it aside and tried to think about what I had just seen on the video. I wasn't sure yet how I would use it, but I knew without a doubt it was courtroom gold. We had captured on film a rogue drug agent and his accomplice planting drugs in Stratton Sturgis's house as some sort of scheme to eliminate or control him as a witness.
This took things far beyond anything I was expecting. I whistled low as I closed the iPad and then started putting it back into Lorna's bag.
Okay, now can you tell me what that is and what you're so excited about that it has you whistling?
I nodded. Okay, you saw that we amended our witness list yesterday, right?
Yes, and the judge wants to talk about it today.
Right, well that was part of a play.
You mean like one of Legal Siegel's moves?
Yeah, but it's my move. We're calling it Marco Polo. The amended list had lots of new names on it. You heard Forsythe complain about them.
Yes.
Okay, one of the names on the list was Stratton Sturgos. The list was designed to make it look like we were cloaking him, sort of hoping to slip him through with all the others. He was listed right in the middle of all the names of the tenants from Gloria's building. But the play is that we wanted the prosecution team to think that we were up to something and to look for the name that we were hiding in plain sight.
Stratton Sturgos.
Right.
So who is Stratton Sturgos?
It's not really who he is, it's where he lives. This video is from his house in Glendale. It is directly across the street from a house where 10 years ago, two drug dealers were murdered.
And what's that have to do with Gloria Dayton?
Nothing directly, but we've been trying to make the connection between Lankford, the DA investigator who was following Gloria before her murder, and Agent Marco with the DEA, who she snitched for. For our defense theory to work, those two have to be connected somewhere down the line. That's what Sisko has been working on, and we thought we found it in that unsolved double murder case. The lead investigator on it was then Glendale Police Detective Lee Lankford, and the two victims were connected to the Sinaloa cartel, the same group Hector Moya is connected to. We know Marco had a hard-on for Moya back then, so it stands to reason he and his unit, the Interagency Cartel Enforcement Team, ICE-T for short, were aware of and maybe even working on the two guys that got whacked in that house.
Okay.
That was her way of saying she still didn't get it. We thought that the double murder was the connection, but Sisko got copies of Lankford's old investigative files on the case, and nowhere in any report is Marco or Ice-T even mentioned. So we set up a play with a witness list that we thought would draw them out if there was a connection. I pointed down to her bag where the iPad was stashed. The video proves it. Lankford and Marco are connected, and I'm going to turn this trial upside down with it. It's a game changer. I just have to decide when to change the game.
But what was the play? How is Sturgos connected?
He isn't connected. He just lives across the street from the house where those dealers were killed. We knew we could use him to smoke out Lankford and Marco.
I'm sorry, don't get angry, but I still don't understand.
I'm not angry. Look, Lankford now works for the DA. He got himself assigned to the Lacoste case so he could watch over it because, remember, he was following Gloria the night she was killed. So it's his job now to work with Forsythe and help prepare for whatever moves the defense makes. As soon as court was over yesterday, you better believe he and Forsythe sat down with that new witness list and tried to figure out what I was up to. Like, who was important and who I was really going to call.
And they see the name Stratton Sturgos.
Exactly. They see that name, and it means absolutely nothing to them. So Lankford goes to work. He's an investigator. He has a computer and a whole array of law enforcement access and data at his fingertips. He finds out pretty quickly that Stratton Sturgos lives on Salem Street in Glendale, and that would have rung a pretty big bell for him because he worked that two-bagger on Salem 10 years ago.
The double murder he never cleared.
Right. So either on his own, or at Forsythe's request, he needs to check out Mr. Sturgos and see what his connection is to the Dayton case. This is what Sisko and I thought would happen. We also thought, or more like hoped, that if that double murder was the point of connection between him and Marco, Lankford might call up his buddy, the DEA agent, and say, I gotta check this guy out.
You want to back me up in case we are going to have a problem?
So you set up the cameras. I get it now. But what happened to Sturgios?
A week ago, we knocked on his door and said we wanted to rent his house for 2 weeks for a film production.
You mean like location scouts or something?
Exactly. I smiled, because the ruse we had used wasn't actually a ruse. We had indeed produced a film. Only this film's premiere wasn't going to be a red carpet affair on Hollywood Boulevard. It was going to premiere in Department 120 of the Criminal Courts Building on Temple Street downtown. So Sturgios took our money and then took his wife on a little vacay to see their daughter in Florida. We set up cameras around his house and put the name Stratton Sturgios on the witness list as a depth charge. Now we have this. I pointed to her bag on the floor between my feet. You can tell from the video that Marco was hanging back, I continued. Langford went to the door by himself. If Sturgios had been home and answered, he would have started with a legit interview. You know, I work for the DA, your name is on the witness list, what do you know about this, and so on. Marco would stay back, but be ready if Langford determined that they had a problem with Sturgios.
Be ready to do what? Lorna asked.
Whatever was necessary. Look at Gloria. Look at Earl. This guy doesn't have boundaries. Look what we have on video. Sturgios wasn't there, so Marco breaks in and plants drugs in the freezer. That was so they could come back and pop Sturgios if they needed to. It would keep him from testifying or ruin his credibility if he did.
The whole thing is incredible.
And it's going to be pure gold in court. We just need to figure out when to spring it. I could barely contain myself while thinking about the possibilities for use of the video.
You don't have to turn it into the police? Lorna asked.
Nope. It's our video. I'm thinking we use it to play them off against each other. See if we can get one of them to turn against the other. The weaker one. Nothing works better with a jury than an insider spilling his guts. It's better than video. It's better than fucking DNA.
What about Sturgios? What are you going to do to protect him? You pulled him into this and he doesn't...
Don't worry about him. First of all, I'm sure Sisko took care of the drugs Marco planted. Second, we have the video. Nobody's going to lay anything on Stratton Sturgios. He's lying on a beach somewhere in Florida and $4,000 happier.
$4,000? Where did that come from?
I used my own money.
Mickey, you better not be tapping Haley's college fund. That would be all you need to have go wrong with her.
I'm telling you, I didn't. She didn't respond, and she didn't seem mollified, probably because she could tell I was lying. But I had more than a year before I needed that money to pay for college. I checked my watch and then looked at the slowly moving river of steel in front of me. See if you can get over and get off at Alvarado, I instructed. We're never going to get there at this pace.
Whatever.
It was her annoyed tone again. She was still fuming about my being 10 minutes late for pickup. Or maybe about where I had been that made me 10 minutes late. Or maybe it was a holdover from our angry words the day before. Whichever didn't matter. I missed Earl. He never added any tone to his commentary. He never got lost, and he knew better than to sit in the middle of an unmoving freeway when I was due in court.
What if Marco Polo hadn't worked? Lorna asked.
What do you mean?
What if they hadn't zeroed in on Stratton Sturgios? What would have happened then?
I thought for